a poem by Rumi. What will our children do in the morning? Will they wake with their hearts wanting to play the way wings should? Will they have dreamed the needed flights and gathered the strength from the planets that all men and women need to balance the wonderful charms of the earth so that her power and beauty does not make us forget our own? I know all about the ways of the heart, how it wants to be alive. Love so needs to love that it will endure almost anything, even abuse, just to flicker for a moment. But the sky's mouth is kind. Its song will never hurt you, for I sing those words. What will our children do in the morning if they do not see us fly? So tonight we are on the sixth talk of the series of five fears, with at least one more talk and perhaps two more talks to go. I haven't decided yet whether I want to prolong the subject any longer. But in any case, I think it's one that gets at the crux of a lot of the ways we inhibit the flow of life and block our own creativity and spontaneity. So I hope you're finding these series of talks useful for yourself, and we're picking out different attributes of fear and looking at those attributes. But really the practice of meditation is a kind of a journey, you might say, from those that avoid fear at all costs, which is where most of us start in practice. We avoid fear at all costs, to a continuum in which we learn to love the mystery more than we dislike fear. And we're willing to go through fear to get to the mystery, because fear is what blocks the mystery. And at some point, there's a kind of a critical threshold that we reach in which fear is always challenging. And there's no question about that. But it also is enlivening, because we realize that the messages of fear are inherently untrue. And the love for what's on the other side of that untruth begins to entice us and enrichen our perspective of the world. So we're willing to take fear head on. Now, tonight's talk is on fear of unusual states of mind. And I would like to start off with a story. I was at a retreat not too many years ago, two or three years ago, down at Spirit Rock, and one of the women on the retreat started acting sort of funny, standing up and sort of shaking and dancing and having a lot of energetic responses. So I took her down to a place, a safe house, and just started speaking with her. And she was sitting across from me, and suddenly we were speaking together, and suddenly she started speaking about me to me. And I thought, well, because I didn't have any reference for that, I thought, well, maybe she doesn't know who I am, and she's speaking about Rodney, thinking I'm someone else. And then at that moment, I was looking right in her eyes, and I saw her her consciousness move off to a point where I had no tether anymore. It wasn't grounded. It was no longer governed. And she was having a psychotic break. And I knew that I had no expertise in this whatsoever. I can only work with somebody who has a tether, a line to reality, and wishes or can, is willing to move down to that line to some stability of orientation, so then we can deal with whatever is out there. But if you don't have that tether, how do you bring a consciousness down? So I was completely lost in what to do. Thank the universe for having a psychiatrist present at that retreat who actually was from the Seattle area, who worked with her for the next day or so. But what it showed me, because I'd never had that kind of face-to-face interaction and split from reality in such dramatic presentation, was just the enormous respect we have to give to the power of the mind. And when we're looking at the fear of unusual states of mind, not to be too emboldened here, not to be too arrogant, and our dismissive quality of what lies ahead of us in this journey. We simply don't know. And what those kinds of examples do for me is give me a great deal of respect for what is left of this last roar of the lion. It takes time and patience to do this work. And perhaps more than anything else, it takes kindness. Which is one of the reasons I read the poem I did, you know, the open face of the sky is kind. The open face. The willingness to trust and not to protect is ultimately absolute kindness. But most of us are wedged between the difficulties of mind and body and trying to open that space of sky. And we're constantly being pushed by the inward forces of our own mind to get there. And so we need a kind of delicate and gentle response to this, not a hardened, dismissive attitude. And above all, we need the love of the mystery. The love of the mystery, I think, is absolutely key to having the willingness, the perseverance, and the maintaining of the intentionality to go through what is... Well, anyone in their right mind would have no business with this thing at all. Why would I sit here and do the very thing that every cell in my body tells me to run and flee from? We're talking about looking at fear. We're talking about looking at the most difficult aspects of ourselves, our mind, and sitting still with that. We have to have a love of something to get us through the endless presentations that are in front of us. But we smell something. We smell a possibility and potentiality. And I think the beauty of the different array of teachers that we have coming through Seattle Insight is that each one of those teachers, by the very fact that they are teaching and are reputable, have tasted something that perhaps the majority of those in the audience haven't. And perhaps they can communicate the enticing potential that waits if we develop the right orientation to the fears as they present themselves. You begin to see that fear is like a faulty oil light on your car. That it comes on, flashing its warning signal, but in fact, it's broken. I had a friend who had just that experience, had a faulty oil light in his car. And the oil light would come on, and as soon as it would come on, he would take his can of oil and he would dump it in the motor, never looking at the dipstick. And his car was awash in oil to the point where it eventually broke down from too much oil. Okay, so we want to find out if the gauge, if our gauge is working here. We want to test this light, this fear light that comes on and terrorizes us with its flashing signal of warning. Is it true? To ask the simple and most profound question we can ask. Okay, the light's on. Let me check the dipstick. That's all. Is this true? Now, usually we don't have the space to ask that question. We don't have the orientation to ask that question. In fact, we don't have usually the time to ask that question. Fear hits too quickly and jars us too abruptly. And we're off following the mechanisms of adding more oil. We just contract around and flee, because that's what, as an animal species, we've learned to do with this physiological, psychological response. And slowly, the awareness of our attention gets wetter, which is the saving grace, because as it gets wetter, which means more subtle, the cues of fear, the very beginning signals of the light coming on, not the full red glare of the oil, but just the light pink before it becomes dramatically red, becomes the miscue, becomes the reason for holding our seat. Okay, let me look here. Is this true? Is this true? And the question isn't one of verbal, it isn't a verbal question, it's a question of orientation. And knowing the lie of fear so repetitiously from the many years that we have studied it, we hold our seat. And we hold our seat through the fear because of the love of the mystery. There's a KM group. I'm not sure that many people were aware of it. This KM group that was formed by a group of 10 or so people in this room was a KM that invited Palestinians and Israelis to come and offer their view and perspective of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to the KM. And they had, I don't know, maybe half a dozen or so speakers who were very, I'm sure, very opinionated and very conclusive about how they and why they were feeling the way they were feeling with that orientation. And one of the people that was in the KM group said to me, one of her biggest teachings was, as these people paraded through, and she and the group tried to maintain a stability of listening openly, with an open attitude, without losing reference and clarity within the, I'm sure, grisly scenes from which many of these people had lived their lives. She said, what I've learned is whether it's sad or desperate, painful or fearful, you enter it. It's worth doing. You do it. Now that's the lion's roar. That is the love of the mystery playing forth in perhaps one of the hardest and most contentious KM groups we've ever had. I don't know what happens in your KM groups, but it would have to be pretty dramatic to beat that one. And yet, what this one person was saying, and I only spoke to one in depth about it, was that no matter what it was worth doing. No matter how difficult it was, you see, no matter how fearful, no matter how reactive the voices, it was worth going into. Now, why would you do that? You're not doing that so that you can form the same opinions as the speakers. That's not the point of Dharma. You're going into the very cave in which opinions are formed and finding a new solution, a new way of holding the different voices in a non-fearful way. That's the holding one's seat. That is the movement from the continuum in which my life is about avoidance of that very thing into and through the continuum of experience in which fear begins to resound as a potentiality and a possibility and as a limitation that I can break out of here, that we can be free of. So when we talk about the fear of unusual states of mind, what brings forth, you see, what lurks inside of me? I used to have a lot of fear of what lurked inside of me when I was a Dharma student. I was afraid that just below the surface, there was the horror of what I feared was there. Because of the history of drama in our family, I did not trust that same rage wasn't in myself. Where are each of our fears and what lurks within and under the surface of our consciousness? How willing are we to hold our seat within that fear? Perhaps we're talking about one of the most resilient fears in this series, is the fear of what's inside of me. It's really fear of ourselves that we're talking about here. Evil, the evil, you know, and most of us have set out patiently upon this path not to be present to evil, but to be transformed into the good. And yet the voices are not often benign within us. They aren't often benevolent. They're often full of the rages of our history, the memories, the experiences. And as soon as we hear those voices, we clutch ourselves back into the childlike pose from whence they arrived. There was a Dharma student that I had. I've told this story before, so be patient if you've heard it. She was really considered herself to be kind of a earth mother. And she had a child, you know, literally, she was out hoeing her garden with a child in one hand and a hoe in the other. Or maybe it was tucked into one of those cradle bibs. But in any case, the child started crying while she was trying to do her gardening. And she had this malicious thought she wanted to kill the child. And she comes in complete, because she felt it, she really wanted to strangle the child. I mean, mothers and fathers, you've had that experience, I'm sure. But this woman, it didn't fit her perspective, you see. Not Earth Mother doesn't have... And so she wondered whether she should call Child Protective Services. Not really, but... So she wanted to talk to me about that. And I said, you know, what thought... Is there any thought that would have the repugnance of that one to you? And she said, no, that's the worst. That's the most terrorizing thought that she thought she could have. I said, that's why it came up. Do you think the mind is just going to go along with you? Okay, now I'm the Earth Mother. So everything, follow the way of the sun and the moon. I'll be damned, says the mind. That's what it does. You charge it in a certain direction, and it'll come at you to prove that direction is false. So be careful where you stand. And in fact, there's only one stance that won't bring the lion to your throat. And that's no stance at all. That's the open friendliness, the open kindness of the sky. In which all voices are tolerated. Make a single distinction and you've exposed your jugular. That's the humility that we need when we enter this practice. But what can we do? We have to see it. We have to see the various disguises, the various permutations of the mind, all the voices. In Siddhartha, that wonderful book by Hermann Hesse, at the end of the Siddhartha's life, he's listening to all the voices of the river, all the countless voices. In the poem, all the planets open you to the sky. And most of us continue to struggle with our mind. The struggle itself is engendering more fear into those different voices. For there are the emotions themselves. And behind the difficult emotions, there's often a fear response in having that emotion, to having that emotion. When anger comes up, anger does not come up alone. Secondary to anger is a fear of having anger. And there is another permutation even beyond that. That is the fear of what anger is saying about me. And so we meet this array of emotions with camouflaged intention to subvert it. Not to really open, not to learn how and where does mystery dwell in the middle of this anger? How and where does mystery dwell in the middle of this expression of fear? For their mystery has to be present simultaneously. But again, we get captured in the kind of contracted spirit of fear, being afraid of what the emotion is and what it says about me. I am an angry person. So in Dharma practice, we undermine, we take the roots out of that system. We don't add an I, me, and mine to the emotion. Not because we're trying to get over fear and onto the thing, because it doesn't substantiate itself, it doesn't point anywhere. The I, me, and mine doesn't designate anything. It's a false designation. It's another false oil light signal. It's just this emotion. It's just this fact. It's just what's occurring. Then when the voices arise, it's merely a representation of where we're holding and grasping. I want to be the Earth Mother. I'm going to get strangled. You put whatever you want to be, and you will get strangled. The mind will show you, deservedly so, that you are not that, by giving you the absolute antithesis of your expectation. And the more you want to hold that image, the more the mind will come at you to undermine that image. Let go of the image, and it has nowhere to leash out. And then we have the fears of our practice fears. Oh boy. What we will become when we sit down. The fear of emptiness. We hear these words. God, sounds barren. The fear of being in an unfamiliar state of mind, the fear of quiet, the fear of darkness when I close my eyes. Where is the old me? We feel shaken when we sit. Suddenly we're not packaged back together in the same way. When we sit, we don't know who we are or what we are. Never mind that the old mold was the reason that sent you to sitting in the first place. You want to return to that mold as soon as you get shaken. You see, we want to change, but we want to change on our own terms. We want to be in control of how we change, don't we? But when we're in control of how we're changed, then we're controlling our change according to an idea we have about how we should be. And so then we're just living according to an image. Self-perceived. In fact, most of the teachers we seek hold some kind of perception of what we want to be. Present company excluded. It's not the mystery. We have to go further than that. We have to go beyond the mind here. Beyond our need to control. Beyond the trust level factor. The trust that has to be broken. Trusting in only our own sense of derivation and artistry. Creating our own future. When we practice that moment of being shaken, okay, most of us go into that for a moment and we don't know who we are and it feels kind of ambiguous and we come out of it and we get ourselves back to our old sense of me and then it happens again and we feel a little more comfortable, but still then we come back and we get back into the old sense of me. And after about X number of those times, it doesn't matter so much whether we're a little more ambiguous, whether our definition is a little less formed. It's not so terrifying. That's how most of us find our way out of the old sense, the old molding. And that's what meditation practice is supposed to be doing. It's supposed to be making your edges fuzzy. That's what it's supposed to do. So that we're not so certain about I, me, and mine. But that's not what many of us want from the meditation. We want the certainty of I, me, and mine, and the change along with it. We want to carry ourselves to enlightenment and then proclaim ourselves from that place. Can't have it that way. So then we have the looming shadow. You see, I want to talk a little bit about the shadow. All of this, when we sit down, it's like, we're right on the interface between the conscious and the unconscious and the subconscious, right? Right there where the strata isn't so solid anymore. And the images that come through that strata are sometimes colorful and sometimes dramatic, and we begin to see that it's very porous, that it isn't cement there, and that it's just the fear that keeps it at bay at all. And as our willingness to tolerate more of ourselves and more expressions of our mind, then the unconscious and subconscious starts playing forth within the conscious. Which was only the tension was kept out because of our fear of it. And in that lies the shadow. Now the shadow, when I was a boy, we had a movie, a television show called The Shadow. Something like Twilight Zone-ish, a little bit. But I just want to tell you a way to handle some of the worst ways. I'll give you a story, a ghost story. It's a ghost story. So the lamp, you know, and all that. So a little fire going. And so it's a true story. But it's not to freak you out. It's to it's to give you some sense of how to work with this. So I was a student at the Insight Meditation Center in about 1978. I had been practicing a few years at that point. And I was on staff. And we were having a staff retreat. And I went into the library to lie down on the couch after an early morning sitting. I was tired. And I was just lying there, and there was light on in the library. And there are big wooden planked floors. And I heard the floors creaking. And I looked, and I couldn't see anybody, but I could hear footfalls of creaking back and forth. And then the footfalls stopped, and I could feel, a lot of this, I'm not sure what I was at the time and what I didn't embellish, what I haven't embellished since then, but I'll just tell you the story as my mind plays it out. You know, I could feel sort of a presence, and that the actual noise stopped, and the person then started coming towards me, and you could hear the creaking of the floor as it approached. And I was lying on the floor. Now, I was in the middle of a staff retreat, so I was actually extraordinarily calm. God knows why. Probably couldn't recover that these days, but anyway, it was there then. So then, I felt this presence, and I felt some hostility in it. In fact, at that moment I felt the hostility, I felt something grab right here in my solar plexus. And I just went inside. Again, I am not a brave person, but somehow I didn't get too frightened. And I just sat there feeling the sensations of this attack to my midsection. And then I felt the release of that grasp, the entity stand up, and I could feel the frustration of it. And then I felt and heard him leave the library. So what it taught me was the shield, the guard of awareness around of forces, external and internal, that awareness provides, that mindfulness provides, and how fear shatters that shield of protection and sends us into the most identified and therefore the most vulnerable places where fear and intrusive forces can get a hold of us. Now, that doesn't mean that we're all going to benignly and quietly be able to have these experiences when and if they happen to us. But it gave me a kind of a trust that there is a protective factor within our mindfulness. And you can sometimes feel that, can't you, when you're practicing? There's a kind of way that the practice brings forth. My teacher used to say, the Dharma protects those who protect the Dharma. It's just a sense of, I don't know, of protection somehow. I don't usually speak about it that way, but when we're talking about the enormous forces inwardly of our own mind, I think it's very important to know that awareness itself has a protective quality to it. Because our worst desires is that we're going to become this thing, that it's going to take us over, that we're going to lose our conscious intention and become what that mind state is. In fact, when we look at how it is that we lose ourselves in rage or terror or whatever it is that we're most afraid of, it's through the identification, not through mindfulness. It's through actually the embellishment of the wallowing in that emotion, the total identification of it, and the energy state itself. In fact, if we can maintain a sense of perspective, knowing that it's arising, knowing that it's present, that is a safeguard from losing ourselves in that context, within that context. Now, the shadow is the part of ourselves that we are in constant terror of, fear of. It's dramatically different than the way we want to be. And it's because we have, again, formed an image of the way we want to be that a shadow even has the ground to be fertile. When you say, I want to be like this, then everything of the mind that isn't like this doesn't just say, okay, I guess I'm on vacation, I'll just take off. It gets subverted and its energy becomes more intensified and it finds a way to show itself through the pain body, the expression of the pain, from in time and time and time again. Because the tension that we place in saying, I want to be like this, is exactly the reverse tension of everything that we don't have in alignment with that particular ideal. It holds the same tension as our wanting to be like this, our not wanting to be like this, has equal and opposite tension. Do you see that? So the leaning towards something is also the resistance towards something else. And so that brings both the resistance and the leaning, bring those states forward. So it's very important that we do not create a shadowed leaning in relationship to our inward experience. In fact, the whole of consciousness, the whole of human consciousness is in each one of us. We cannot decide that we only want a part of it, and to claim ownership of that part. We have to claim the totality. Which means what? Whatever arises, release the fear and meet it seated, straightforward. In fact, if you hold the tension too tightly, that leads to the projection of that quality on to the population at large. I don't know how many of you saw the Gary Ridgway's press. I was very interested in his mind. And they were showing some interviews of him in the 48 or 50-some women that he killed, prostitutes. And how, and I could see his mind become that murderer as he described what he was feeling in terms of the killing prostitutes, when he was around prostitutes, you know, and all the, and, you know, you could just feel the inward tension, probably around sexual promiscuity or whatever, and whatever that meant to his own life, probably his mother, so I don't know. But that he was going to stamp it out through killing, you see? That's how he was going to take care of that projection, through killing. Well, that's exactly what's happening in terms of wars and religious conflicts and Iraqi and Arabs. And it's just a permutations of the same thing. If somebody could turn that off, please. So we want to bring a very simple relationship to fear and to the shadow. First, all things arise in its dramatic form from a very simple, easily experienced sense of unpleasantness. It's unpleasant. This mind state is unpleasant. That in itself, each one of us can hold. That in itself is not drama. It's just an experience of a little bit of unpleasantness, or a lot of unpleasantness, an intense unpleasantness. So, But it's a jumping off place. Instead of being able to hold the unpleasant quality of fear, we jump into the drama of what fear is projecting our life will be in a few moments if we don't alter course. But if we stay with the unpleasantness in the body, we can learn how to just base ourselves in that feeling without losing ourselves in the drama, within the terror of the message of fear. It's the message of fear. It's the message of anger. It is the content, the justification, the explanation, the future orientation that is the problem. Not in what the body is delivering forth. The body's deliverance is what is the jumping off place. It's where the dive happens, the dive into the air of thought, off the diving board, off the platform of the unpleasant. Stay on the platform. Reside with both feet on the platform. Okay, I'm pleasant. I can work with that. Now, it's not just the shadowed areas that we're afraid of. As we begin to practice, you'll find that there are a lot of alluring qualities of mind that come forth too. In fact, very enticing qualities of mind. Extraordinary realms of peace and tranquility and open-heartedness and tenderness that feel almost like a heaven realm. Sublime. And what fear does is it's afraid of losing that. It's so, I mean, sometimes my heart gets so open. It is so tender and so precious. I don't want it to close down. I don't want to lose that. You see, that's the fear. That's the fear. It's not. Nothing can be held on to for more than a second. So the willingness to release those qualities back into the mystery, back into the unfolding, not back into their, not for their continuation, not hoping that they'll come back again and doing everything we can to create their arising, but just folding everything back into the mystery. Everything back, even the sublime quality of heart that feels a light insect touch your leg. Because what we think of is, oh, this is finally the holy. This is the holy. How can that realm of the heart, how can that not be the holy? This must be the arriving place. See, that is the conversation. That is the subtlety. Now fear is taken on a different tone. Now it's taken on a different language. Now it's taken on a different perspective. No longer is it the terror of the shadow. Now it's the luring sound of the siren's voice. Stay with me. Don't part. You need this. This is what you've wanted. Those are also the voices of fear. Are we strong enough? Are we able to see even the flashing of those lights? The false warning, the false sound of even that most alluring quality. This must be it, we say. And then we are fixed. Then we are located. Then we are contracted around something. And then fear has us because we have exposed ourselves. We've exposed the image, and fear will come at us. What we meet that fear with is investigation. Is this true? Is this the final? Is there any final resting state? Is there any experience that is going to hold and last forever? Investigation. Is this the direction of less me, of more mystery, or a firmer, more defined me? Whenever we have an image, it's a more defined me. We question that. Which way am I going here? Is this towards wise view or towards the view that perpetuates the misery and pain that I've been in my whole life? Does this view lead to the welfare, to my general welfare and to the welfare of others? That's the investigation. is this really so terrifying? Can I look at this? Is this true? And then perhaps, what can I learn from this? What can I learn from the sublime? What can I learn from the shadow? What is this experience telling me? Not to hold on, but what is it telling me? How is it informing? How is it broadening the sky of kindness? Wholeness is holy. Wholeness is holy. And wholeness includes fear. We have to take it all. We have to take it all. Just as it is, we have to take it all. No division. No separation. No image. No posturing. No moving towards the alluring qualities. No resistance towards the shadow. The wholeness is holy. The wholeness is the mystery. That's what it demands of us, is our whole attention. Can we sit for a minute or two?